You don't know what's going to happen. That's why gambling doesn't make any sense.
But that's why it does make sense, honey. Don't you see? If a person knew what was going to happen, there wouldn't be any point.
Why?
Why? Because it wouldn't be a gamble then.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to an eargasmic edition of the U.S. Racing Show. I am your friendly host, Derek Simon, and this is the show where we talk about everything and anything related to the sport of kings and also just to the gambling world in general. In fact, Kevin Rogers is back on this week's program. We're going to talk a little bit about March Madness. That, for those of you who don't know, is the NCAA basketball tournament. A lot of fun there. A lot of people really get into it. I get the whole hoopla and the excitement. I'm just not a huge basketball fan these days. Love the athleticism. Just don't watch that much basketball. I don't do much of anything, to be honest with you, anymore. I don't know what's going on. But I am always on the lookout for good races. And before we go any further, there are a few things that you need to know.
I'm looking forward to completing your training. In time, you will call me Master.
Alrighty then. I learn it from a book.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're gonna remember this the rest of your life.
Oh, I already knew that.
I don't get it.
What part didn't you understand?
Will you never learn?
Help you, I can. Yes.
This is the time of year when things get really interesting, not only in terms of the Kentucky Derby, but also the Kentucky Oaks. And there was a prep of sorts for the Kentucky Oaks at Oaklawn Park, the Honeybee. And here's the way it went.
Three quarters, 112-4, and they run to the top of the stretch. Cosmic Evolution about to be challenged by Terra Promessa. And Terra Promessa is now set down for the drive by Santana and moves away. Nickname coming to her outside with Cosmic Evolution back third. Through the final furlong, Terra Promessa has the lead by three. Up into second is Nickname, so Asmussen's 1-2. Cosmic Evolution is clearly third, but the clear-cut winner is Terra Promessa. Stylish in victory by 4-5. Nickname second, Cosmic Evolution third, then Dora Danza and She's a Bootsy two, and 147 flat.
The interesting thing to me is Terra Promesso wins that race. Of course, they prep for the Kentucky Oaks. 26-1 in pool one of the Kentucky Oaks future wager. You're not going to believe this. Songbird, 3-5 in that pool. Now, this is why I don't like a lot of future wagers. What sense does that make? I mean, it's highly dubious that Songbird is going to be 3-5 in the Kentucky Oaks, yet she's 3-5 in a future pool, which the way these futures work, you got to make the race, you got to win the race. So it's not just about winning, it's about actually making the race. And Songbird is 3-5. Now, sharp bettors can take advantage of this. Because what we're seeing with Songbird is all the social media hype. We're seeing all the casual fans just piling on to the Songbird bandwagon. So as we get into future races, this is something to keep in mind. A lot of times in horse racing, people believe that you're trying to pick the winner, which, yeah, that's part of it. And obviously, if you could pick every winner, that would be the sole goal of handicapping. But that's not the way it works. I always advise people to look at handicapping like you would insurance. When you get insurance rates, when people come up with insurance rates, they don't do it based on being right about you. Let's talk about the terrible, terrible aspect of profile. Well, I'm being profiled. Yeah, you are. And you're definitely being profiled by insurance companies. And as handicappers, I would argue that you want to do race, how do you put this? Racial, meaning a race profiling. That's going to come across very, very poorly. Derek Simon, he's a racist. He's advocating that we be racist. No, I'm saying in terms of a race, you're profiling. I'm just digging myself a deeper hole. But I know, I hope anyway, that people understand what I'm talking about. The idea is you're looking for those broad generalities. You're not necessarily looking at a particular horse. This is a huge mistake when people do this. And I've talked to so many novice bettors, and they look at a race and a horse as this is a can't miss. You know, we're going to go out and we're going to bet our can't miss choices. Well, you learn over time that they can miss. The jockey can fall off. There can be a disqualification. There are so many things that can go wrong in a horse race. So anytime that I hear people guaranteeing picks or talking about certainties or locks, I know that either the person is a shyster and they're trying to sell you something, or they're not winning at the racetrack, because it's just not the way it works. You have to understand that you're playing probabilities, and that's how you profit in the game. And the fact that people are willing to take 3 to 5 on a future wager on Songbird just shows you that they are not looking at generalities. They are not looking at probabilities. They just believe that Songbird is this super filly and can't be beaten. I always bring up Secretariat. Probably the greatest horse in 50 years, was beaten several times in his career and beaten fairly in several of his races. So just goofy odds on Songbird. And I would be looking at alternate contenders for the Kentucky Oaks. Of course, the one name that comes to mind immediately is Catherine Sophia. There was another big race at Santa Anita, the Big Cap, the Santa Anita Handicap, and it was won in a very interesting way.
3/8 of a mile to go. Melatonin, General A-Rod puts the pressure on. Donworth is just loaded, still nowhere to go. He almost clipped heels. In the meantime, FNX makes his move on the outside. Melatonin, FNX on the outside. General A-Rod the first to come under pressure. Imperative Extreme outside. Hard Aces is trying to now get his way through traffic. Down at the rail, Donworth, Point Piper, and Class Leader. They're at the top of the stretch. And Melatonin is running the race of his life. He leads by 2 now. Donworth gets clear sailing on the inside of FNX Imperative. Inside of him, Hard Aces. They're in the final furlong, and it is Melatonin, and he's putting them to sleep in the Big Cap under Joe Talamo. Melatonin airs. He wins by 5.
If I were teaching a class on racetrack handicapping, thoroughbred handicapping, this would be a race that I would use as an example. Because I remember last year, a lot of talk, a lot of buzz about Run Happy, some of it good, some of it not so good. And this is a horse that I was interested in talking about Run Happy because I'd observed his training methods and I loved what the connections were doing. It was all about building stamina. It was all about building fitness. It was about working hard, which I've said before, and I've gotten a lot of flack for saying this, but I have kind of developed this appreciation of that kind of method from my own training. Because I'm an avid gym goer. I love to go to the gym, love to lift weights. And I've made the point that if I were to go in and not work out, let's say in a week, I would probably be very, very strong because there's no aches and pains. I'd feel great. I'd be able to bench more, be able to squat more, you name it. But I wouldn't be fit. And it brings up the much greater possibility, in my opinion, of injuries. And I think that's what we see in racing. We're told that the horses are fragile. They're treated as though they're fragile. And so consequently, they live down to those low expectations. I love the idea of getting horses fit. Now, what has this got to do with Melatonin? Well, I heard that Run Happy was a sprinter. He can only sprint. And the connections, when I spoke to them, they actually had the audacity, the gall, to talk about winning the Breeders' Cup Classic, to which, of course, there was the predictable scoffing, and, oh, that's ridiculous. He's a sprinter. Why is he a sprinter? Because he's won sprints, and his one route try was poor. But, of course, he was hurt in that race. Melatonin would not have been in the Big Cap if not for Joe Talamo. Joe Talamo was telling the connections, this horse can go further. Melatonin was a sprinter. And when I looked at the pace figures in this race, they blew me away. Now, I've talked before about my ESRs and my LSRs, early speed rations, late speed rations. The early speed rations, the lower the figure, the better. The late speed rations, the greater the figure, the better. So there's an inverse relationship between the two. Typically, if you go very fast early, you don't expect to be going fast late. That's, again, racing 101. minus 10 ESR for melatonin. That is a brisk pace. That's very, very good. Yet he came home with a minus 4 LSR. Now, the pace profile is comparing those two figures. Did the horse go relatively faster late or relatively faster early? Here, melatonin went relatively faster late. But this horse is a sprinter. It just goes to show the danger of early speed. It's why William Kieran called it the universal bias. It's why races in the old days, were speed oriented. You look at the Kentucky Derby. You realize how many Kentucky Derbies were wired in the early going? Something you don't see very often. Because speed has been restrained. We talk about, well, we're breeding for speed. That's why these horses are fragile. But we're not. They're not getting faster. It's great to see a horse like Melatonin. It's great to see the faith that a jockey had in this horse to tell the connections, hey, I think this horse can go longer. And Melatonin, not only did he set a fast pace, but he was challenged at the head of the stretch. FNX, a non-factor in this race. Great to see, and I hope we see more of that. I'm actually seeing some encouraging signs. And by the way, I know there was some talk that the Santa Anita Park strip was biased that day. Well, if you look at the four sprint races, two of them wire to wire. If you look at the three routes, two of them wire to wire. That's four out of the, seven races. Normally, that's obviously a higher rate than normal, but the horses that won and the kind of figures they posted, I just don't think that it's that absurd. And in fact, speaking of that, there was another race won in wire to wire fashion. It was, in fact, the San Felipe, a prep for the Kentucky Derby, and it went like this.
Exaggerator has made a bold move. He's all the way up to take second now, in between horses, coming after Dancing Candy. Just behind them comes More Spirit with five to make up. Then I Will Score and Smoky Image. Dancing Candy turns for home, and he's trying to fend off Exaggerator, who's two lengths behind second. More Spirit is fully extended. Dancing Candy's the real deal. He's in front by two lengths, coming to the 16th pole, and he takes a major step forward this afternoon. Dancing Candy, wire to wire in the San Felipe Stakes, and there's plenty left in the tank. More Spirit closed well for second. Exaggerator third. Uncle Lino was fourth.
This race got a C rating. I've talked before about my grades for Kentucky Derby preps, a C rating, so not bad. But I was really impressed with the other figures. A 110 equibase speed figure that ties Shagoff, who won the Gotham Stakes. The minus 11 ESR, that is Derby quality, and Dancing Candy set that pace. Now, I will say that the Kentucky Derby does not have a great history in terms of being kind to front runners. You've got to show the ability to rate. So Dancing Candy is going to have to come off the pace before I consider him a serious contender in the Derby. But I like the fact that if you're going to wire the race, at least do it in racehorse time. A minus 11 ESR for Dancing Candy certainly fits that. And then a minus 8 LSR, that also very, very good. The other thing that I find interesting about Dancing Candy, and this relates to the whole making money at the races. I talked about Songbird and the ridiculous 3-5 future odds for the Kentucky Oaks. One of the things I think you must do as a player to make money is you have to be quick to react to things. In the future wager, that's the official par mutual wager, Dancing Candy is 17-1. He closed at 17-1 in pool 3. You can go to U.S. Racing right now as I'm recording this program and get 35-1 on Dancing Candy. Now, I talked about this also with some other horses. I believe it was Gunrunner was 45-1, 75-1, some crazy price. He's down to 12-1 now after his big win in the Risen Star. So moving quickly when you find advantages, a big, big key. So check that out at usracing.com. One other big race that affects the three-year-old picture took place on Saturday, and that was the Tampa Bay Derby, where Brody's Cause made his 2016 debut, and it wasn't pretty.
as they turn for home, 3/16 of a mile to run. Brody's car still has about 12 lengths to make up. Lannery swings into the outside, but he's still far back, a furlong to run. These two will dispute it. Destin on the outside. Outwork is there toward the Graham, and they're locked in battle down to the wire. It's Destin on the outside. He's going to better the two. Destin, Outwork, very gamely for second. 5 lengths farther back, Star Hill third. Rafting was fourth. Brody's Cause off the board as the favorite. Running time on the board, 142.82 in the Tampa Bay Derby.
This race also received a C grade, but unlike the San Felipe, a lot of red flags here. First of all, Destin's Equibase speed figure, just a 100. That is the lowest Equibase speed figure next to Motom and Collided, who won the LeCompte and Sham respectively. That among the graded races, graded Kentucky Derby prep races in 2016. Not encouraging. The ESR, a -2. That's incredibly slow. And the fact that Destin was right near the pace and I think wants to be near the pace, that's not what you want to see. That is not facing a Derby-like pace. So he's going to have to show a lot more. The LSR was solid, a -5. That is in line with the historical Derby par. But again, the biggest thing here is pace. And we're going to find out more about that. My first guest is Roger LeBlanc. Roger literally wrote the book on the Kentucky Derby, The Lazy Bettor's Guide to the Kentucky Derby. It's good stuff. He's going to join me next. And then, of course, Kevin Rogers. And we'll talk a little bit of NCAA basketball.
Looking for some action? Well, if it's sports and casino action you're after, USRacing.com has got you covered. At USRacing.com, you can get the latest betting lines on pro and college football, basketball, and all the MLB and NHL action, too. Heck, you can even get the latest odds in the presidential race, the Academy Awards, or who's going to be the next James Bond. Clue, it's probably not going to be P. Diddy, but he's on the list of betting options. And if you're a racing fan like me, you'll love the daily menu and special prop bets. Thoroughbred racing, check. International racing, check. Greyhound racing, check. Harness racing, check. Generous rebates, checkmate. USRacing.com also has a wide variety of casino games as well. So if you're looking for some sports and casino action, look no further than USRacing.com, the place that's setting the pace.
Now, back to your host, while he's still sober, here's Derek.
I'm now very pleased to be joined by Roger LeBlanc. I met Roger several years ago. He wrote a great book about the Kentucky Derby, The Lazy Bettor's Guide to the Kentucky Derby. How you doing, Roger?
I'm doing great, Derek.
This came about because you wrote me last night and you mentioned you'd been on hiatus. And of course, I always loved your book. I thought you had some great tips in there. Tell me a little bit about the hiatus, though. Where you been?
Oh, well, I've just been laying low from the races. Personal life kind of took over. Didn't have a lot of time for handicapping. And if you can't do it right, it's best to just chill out and not do it all for a while. So, but it's Derby time. I'm back.
Yeah, that's a lesson that I'll learn one of these days. You know, I'm working on multiple projects trying to bet the races. Let's talk a little bit about your book because, like I said, I was introduced to you a few years ago, and I just thought your book just hit on so many things that I felt was important in the Kentucky Derby. Number one being you really stress early speed. So let's talk about that a little bit. What should people be looking for in these early preps? You know, we've already seen some of these horses that come from behind and people all impressed about, oh, this horse went the final 16th in this or the final 8th in this. What does Roger LeBlanc look for in a Kentucky Derby contender?
Well, I think the definition of class, it really comes down to how fast a pace a horse can handle. And until a horse has passed that test, that he can handle a stakes level pace, then the final quarters mean almost nothing. There are a few exceptions like Street Sense and Zenyatta, where the early fractions just didn't matter with those horses because they were so good. But those are the rare exceptions. Generally, you want a horse who can run faster, oh, at least average for a stakes level at a particular track, whatever track they're running at. And you can use par times that you purchase to determine that. I have some shorthand ways that I mentioned in my book. Also, last year, I wrote a about an 8-page Derby preview where I mentioned another way that you can kind of determine what a fast pace is for a particular race, and I can get into the details of that if you want to. And
yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, Roger, because, you know, I track the Derby preps, and this is a point that I've made a lot. You look at the preps that have done well recently. What are they? Florida Derby, Arkansas Derby. And people, you know, tend to look at that as, well, that's just a good prep. No, I think it has to do with the pace dynamics. Now, this year, we've got a favorite. In fact, this horse just closed at 7-2 in the final, or not the final future pool, but the penultimate future pool. Mo Heyman, who hasn't really faced a fast pace. He's been racing, of course, in Florida and don't know what the plans are. I think he's going to go in the Florida Derby, so that'll be interesting. But give some folks, because, you know, pace figures can be real confusing. I talk about them all the time, but I don't think a lot of people even know what it is I'm saying when I talk about my pace figures, and I haven't helped much in terms of explaining them. Tell folks how they can do it. Just a quick and dirty read on the early pace, like you were just mentioning.
Okay. The one, my favorite way of doing it in Derby season is, you can go on Wikipedia anywhere and find the times for major Derby preps. So you could take the last 10, runnings of the Florida Derby, for instance, and just come up with an average for both the average six furlong time in those races and the average, finish time. And then just use that average as your barometer. If a horse cannot run to that average early, he probably does not have the speed to withstand a real grade one test like the Derby.
Roger, do you take track condition into account? Like, should we toss sloppy races or races on and off track?
I don't. What I do when I do those averages is I will throw out the outliers. So if you have one race that's exceptionally slower, one race that's exceptionally fast, I'll throw out the outliers and average the rest. And that kind of takes into account any real huge disparities in track surfaces.
Okay. For listeners, too, I should point out that Equibase is a great source for this. You can actually query based on the race, if it's a graded race, and you can get, you know, pretty much all the past runnings up until, I think, 1992, early 90s, somewhere in there. Looking at the Derby picture as it stands right now, Roger, are there some horses that have stood out for you? Obviously, for betters, it's been Mo Heyman, who I talked about, and also Nyquist.
Yes, no one has hit my gold or silver standard yet that I list in the book, but I was really impressed with the race Zulu ran in the Florida Derby to finish second to Mo Heyman, and also Gunrunner, I thought, put up a really good effort against, what was not a super fast pace of Louisiana Derby, but certainly faster than the Louisiana Derby, the Risen Star. But it was certainly an honest pace for this time of year for three-year-olds.
Yeah, I was impressed by Gunrunner. In fact, I talked about the future pools. And by the way, you mentioned the Florida Derby. Obviously, you meant the Fountain of Youth that the Mo Heyman just recently won, the Florida Derby coming up. Is there a particular prep that you look at? Are you one of these guys that says, hey, you know, this prep has been great over the years. I know that Dick Downing does this. Is this something that you look at, or are you more focused in on the horse and what that prep means to that horse?
The latter. Prep races really change in whether they measure up to their grade one status or grade two status. Like the Sunland Derby has produced some really quality horses, surprisingly. Firing Line last year ran second in the Kentucky Derby. And, of course, Mind That Bird. One thing that when I was doing these averages that I mentioned, the one race that was difficult to gauge was the Wood Memorial, because if you use the last 10 years, the average time is really slow. And if you go to the 10 years before that, it's really fast. And in that case, I think the Wood Memorial, because trainers are using fewer and fewer prep races, they're not willing to send their top horse to New York and possibly run on a muddy track or snowy track or whatever might happen up there. And so I think the Wood has been drawing really weak fields the last 10 years. So, you know, 10 years ago, you're saying, oh, the Wood Memorial is a great race. I'm going to use that as my key race. You would have been really disappointed. I think fourth place in the Kentucky Derby is the best that a Wood horse has done in the past 10 years.
You know, it's funny because that to me goes to that pace dynamics. And if there's one area where I've seen, and I really think it's tactical, but just looking at my own pace figures, there is an absolute slowdown in terms of, you know, the early speed component in horses in the Kentucky Derby itself and in some of these prep races. And I especially see it on the East Coast, where a lot of times you got a 6-horse field and everybody's biding their time. It really is an amazing thing to watch. So I am interested in that. And I think that's why a lot of those synthetic tracks didn't really yield a lot of great Kentucky Derby contenders. And when they did, I think of Animal Kingdom in particular, they actually went very, very fast that year. Like you said, the Street Sense race is the outlier because they went so slow in that race. It was a short field, just a crazy, crazy race. But of course, Street Sense had won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile at Churchill Downs. Looking at some of the future bets, I've talked about this a couple times now. I'm not generally a huge fan. I did find it interesting that Mohamed was 7-2 in the pool. I don't know if you heard this, but Songbird in the Oaks, 3-5 for future odds. That's the reason yeah. I don't like that bet. But is there anything that you think, is there any way to make money in the future bets or any way to utilize that even as a hedging strategy?
A few years ago, you could take all other in the first pool and get somewhere in the 5-2 range on that. And I think that was a great hedging tool because of the 23 listed horses, usually only about 6 would make it to the Derby. So that means with all other, you had 14 entrants in the Derby and sometimes ended up with some pretty good contenders there. But now everyone in that first pool bets the heck out of that and it's just not worth it anymore. This year I took, in the most recent pool, I took Zulu at 26-1. I'm very selective in that. It's a tough, it's tough to predict 2 months out what's going to be on the track, for a Saturday in May.
Yeah. And some people take such pride in that. I don't really care. You know, you'll hear people, oh, I liked that horse when he was a 2. I don't care if you liked him when he was a 2-year-old. I care who you like on the first Saturday in May.
That's so random.
You want answers?
What'd you say?
You're right.
Funny how.
Lucy, why don't you answer me?
You're not a eunuch, are you?
What do you all know about death?
Do you have any marijuana I might be able to buy from you?
Is it true that you're in the middle of a nervous breakdown?
Who said that? Why do you say you feel trapped in a man's body?
All right, so these are just random questions off the web. Some of them are good, some of them not so good. This first one I think is kind of interesting. If you could choose your age to be forever, what age would it be?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yes.
Sorry. Well, that's one I wasn't prepared for.
Obviously, okay, obviously younger than you are now, Roger, because you're clearly senile.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I would be younger. I'm 40. I liked 40. That was a good decade for me.
Really? That's interesting. For me, it would definitely be younger than that. All right. Well, here we go. This kind of goes along with it. If you could go back in time, what year would you go to?
Somewhere in the late 60s. I'd love to be part of, experience the Woodstock Summer of Love whole thing. That's something I don't do in ordinary life.
All righty. And last question for you. What chore do you absolutely hate doing?
Taxes. Preparing taxes.
Yeah,
definitely.
That makes sense. All right, my friend. Now, tell folks, how can they get your great book, and do you still have a website? Where can folks get a hold of you?
Yes, lazybetter.com is my website. There's a link to purchase the book there. It'll take you to Amazon to purchase it. And if you want an electronic copy of the book, there's a link there also to purchase an electronic copy, lazybetter.com.
Very good. And I do want to make a personal plug for the book in that, you know, I really don't like books that look at, like, again, a certain prep and say, well, this is a strong prep, because anybody can look at the history of that. I think your book has a much more timeless element, which is very, very important to me when I do, you know, my own methods, angles, and my own Kentucky Derby stuff. I want stuff that's going to stand up over time. I think what you've done in that book will stand up and has stood up over time. So it's been great catching up with you, Roger, and I wish you all the success down the road.
Thanks, Eric. It's been a pleasure being on.
Now, here's why you can win.
Every time you lose, you die a little bit. You die inside, a portion of you. Not all of your organs, maybe just your liver.
In our business, there is no second place. Either you're first or you're last.
You sick, saucy.
When you walk in that door on your two legs all fat and cocky,
you, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
See that? That's your IQ, buddy. Zero.
If you look at this play, what we're trying to get is a seal here and a seal here and trying to run this play in the alley.
Remember, we do everything in reps. So you've done 2 reps of water drinking. Usually we do 10 reps of everything, so do another rep of water drinking.
Well, Kevin Rogers is back, and we are in the heart of it now. Basketball, or NCAA basketball tournament, kicking off. Kevin, it's got to be, for a handicapper like yourself, just a lot of fun, but also kind of a headache, I would think.
You know something, Derek? I like to always use this term. I know it sounds really bad. It's like you can't go to Walt Disney World every single day of the year, you know? And what we do, yes, it's very fun, but at the same time, you follow college basketball the whole year, and now it feels like everybody's coming in at this time of year where, you know, you kind of say, all right, you know, I've been here the whole time, and I got to get excited for this tournament. I love the tournament. I really do. You know, I don't really fill out brackets as much as I used to, just because of what I do now, as far as we're trying to find winners for each of these games, as opposed to looking forward to who's going to be in the Final Four. But, no, it's a great time of year. It really is. And, hopefully you can find some value. And obviously this year, as opposed to last year with Kentucky, the big story, trying to go undefeated the whole way. And they were the team to beat. You know, you have some teams to beat, but really it feels like a very wide open tournament.
Kevin, I'm not an expert by any means in college basketball, but I've heard a lot of griping and complaining about the seedings and the committee got it wrong. Do you share those frustrations?
Honestly, I don't see a huge deal as far as, like, Michigan State is one that's the clear gripe from a lot of people. I thought on Sunday when they beat Purdue in the Big Ten championship that they would be a one seed clearly. I have no problem with Oregon being a one seed. I don't understand why Virginia is a one. Now, Virginia and Michigan State are in the same region. Now, if Michigan State was the one and Virginia was the two, is there that big of a difference? No. I really don't think there's that huge of a difference. And you say, oh, well, Virginia would play a 4 seed and Michigan State would play a 3 seed if everything went according to plan. When you get to the Sweet 16, you got really good teams all over the place that are left, assuming there's not one or two, you know, Cinderellas that jump in some lower seeds. You have really good teams. So does it really make a difference if Michigan State is playing a 3 seed as opposed to a 4 seed. If Michigan State plays Virginia in the final game of that regional, it just matters what color jersey you're wearing. You'll still be playing at a neutral site. So I really don't think it's that big of a deal. It's more of a big deal for teams that obviously got snubbed who just aren't even in the tournament. And a lot of people were talking about Vanderbilt shouldn't have been in, and they got knocked out. Tulsa shouldn't have been in, and they got knocked out in the first four. So, you know, you say, well, would other bubble teams have done better? We don't know, but at the same time, those teams are kind of worthless anyway, so it really doesn't make that big of a difference that they're not in. Kansas is a one. You have Oregon, who had a great season, as a one. Carolina's a one. I got no problem with that. And I think that pretty much it's a hard job to put this whole thing together. You're not going to get it 100% right, but if you can get it 98% right, that's good enough.
I was just going to ask you about that, about, you know, making mistakes in seeding. Does it really matter that much? Because ultimately, you know, you could look at the NFL, let's say, and obviously you're earning your seeding there, but it does matter in the sense that you're not playing as many games if you're a number one seed. But these teams, they're all playing each other. I mean, doesn't it all come out of the wash anyway?
I'll give you an example of something that I'm based in South Florida, and I follow Miami Hurricane basketball a lot this year. They're a 3 seed, all right, in the South region, and they're playing Buffalo on Thursday. Now, I wanted to look and see who else, who the other three seeds were and who the other 14 seeds were to see, you know, how, like, what if Miami got another 14 seed instead of playing Buffalo. And the other ones were Stephen F. Austin, who was playing West Virginia. Stephen F. Austin, 25-7 or something like that, or 27-5. Great record at the Southland Conference, and we've seen them make some noise in the tournament before. Green Bay, who came out of the Horizon League, who beat Valparaiso, and they played Texas A&M. You know, it's a good story. They won 4 games in 4 days. And the other 14 seed is Fresno State. They play Utah in Denver, actually, in your backyard at the Pepsi Center. And Fresno State beat San Diego State. The Mountain West, a little bit watered down this year, not as good as it used to be. But I think to myself, okay, did Miami get the best draw out of those four teams? And I think they did, because Buffalo was a 17-14 team entering the Mid-American Conference tournament. They won 3 straight games to go 20-14. So they say, oh, it's a 20-win team. No, they're a 17-win team, and they won 3 games in 3 days, and they got blown out by Duke and Iowa State in non-conference play. So I feel like that's the best draw they could have gotten, and that's kind of like the randomness sometimes. Not exactly if you should have been a 2, a 3, or a 4, but who were the other teams that share your seeding and who they played? And to say, oh, well, like last year, Baylor lost to Georgia State. What if Baylor played another 14 seed? Would they have advanced? I mean, that's just what it is. This is who you're assigned to. Take care of your business, and that's the end of it. So it's kind of like people can complain all they want if, oh, we should have played this team or that team. Well, too bad. Take care of your business.
All right, so looking at the tournament now, we've talked a little bit about handicapping in your approach. Any games that stand out to you and why?
Well, one I like for tonight, for Thursday, is a late game. Another game that's right there in Denver is Gonzaga and Seton Hall. They play in the late game, in the 6-11 game, and Seton Hall picked up a 6 seed. Now, they won the Big East tournament. I don't think it's unexpected. Now, they did beat Xavier and Villanova, the top 2 seeds, but Seton Hall was the 3rd seed, so it wasn't that huge of an upset. And Seton Hall was a great against the spread team. However, though, I say all that, and however, Seton Hall is in their first tournament with Kevin Willard, who took over the program a few years ago, and, you know, they really had a bad ending to last year, injury suspensions, and this year they really stepped it up and have been one of the big surprises in the country. But they're going from New Jersey to Denver, go to the altitude, late game, not easy. Where Gonzaga, they've been there many, 18 straight tournaments for Mark Few, and obviously he does not have the same players he had over the last 18 years, but still a winning tradition at Gonzaga, not as far of a trip from Spokane to Denver, and for them to play, you know, a late game like that, or at least that kind of time, they're pretty much used to, and they're coming off the West Coast Conference Championship. I just think Gonzaga laying a point or two, I think, is a good look against Seton Hall.
Hey, Kevin, you raised a great point, and I never think about it that much, or, you know, just being here in Denver, but the altitude, how does that affect some of these teams that maybe haven't played in that situation? And also the time, you know, we look at East Coast time, and, you know, if a team is used to playing early games and now they're playing later games, obviously Gonzaga being in the Pacific time zone, they're used to that. But does that affect teams having to kind of change their routine a little bit?
Well, I think it's a twofold with Denver, just with the altitude or playing anywhere, I guess, in that mountain region is, you know, a lot of these, in the NBA, you're kind of used to it. You know, you got to run through Denver every year. So that's just something you have to deal with where, for instance, Iona and Iowa State are playing, the first game in Denver. It's a 2 o'clock Eastern time, a noon mountain time game. So already you're starting the day early in a place you're unfamiliar with. Now, I don't know how much experience Iowa State has playing in the altitude, but for Iona, who comes from New York, that's not going to be easy at all for them. And it's a team that can run, both teams run, so they can score. But you just wonder, you know, how much the defenses will be winded or what the case may be. So you're already playing in an unfamiliar place with a variable as far as altitude, and you're playing early. I mean, at least with the Seton Hall game against Gonzaga, at least they're playing that game, I guess it's an 8 o'clock local game, so it's not terribly throwing you off your schedule. I guess they've been in Denver the last few days, but to play a new local game, that's very hard for both teams. I don't know which team would have the advantage necessarily, But I think that for that situation, that's something you have to put into handicapping with these neutral site games. I always feel like the hardest games to handicap are the neutral site games because both teams, in a sense, are at a disadvantage, so you can't really say.
Yeah, it's something I never think about. I think just being here in Denver, I need to start using it as an excuse in terms of why my cardio is so bad. Well, I'm, you know, getting used to the altitude for the 15th year. In terms of other games, anything else that you're interested in?
Yeah, one other game, a late game tonight in Providence, Arizona, and Wichita State. Wichita State, who's a team that we've seen go far in the tournament the last few years under Greg Marshall. They've gone to the Final Four, and they had a slow start to this season. They needed to be in the first four against Vanderbilt, and they ended up winning that game by 20 after it was tied at halftime. And Wichita State, who is a team that didn't end up getting the automatic bid out of the Missouri Valley because they lost in their tournament, but they ended up at least sneaking in the first four. Now they go from Dayton to Providence to face Arizona. Now, Arizona, for them, obviously the travel from Tucson to Providence is not ideal. I'm sure they would have rather played in Spokane or played in Denver, but they get shipped off to the to New England. However, though, it is a later game, and like I mentioned before about that time, so that they're not playing like a 12:20 Eastern game where it's like, wow, it's really throwing us off. It's a game that's going to start nearly at 10 o'clock Eastern time, so it's at 8 o'clock Mountain time. So really, you're not that far off from what you're used to. And even though Arizona had a couple of slip-ups away from a home this year, I still like them, even though Wichita State has got a game under their belt. I still like Arizona. I think they're a very talented team, and Arizona kind of feels like a team that could either get bounced tonight or make it to the Final Four. That it's one of those situations. They can get knocked out early, and they're in a very tough region of the South. But I think Arizona laying a point or two, I think that's a good look against Wichita State.
Interesting. Well, it's always great talking to you, Kevin, and obviously we got a lot more basketball coming up, so I wish you the best of success, and we'll talk again next week.
All right. Thanks, Derek.